And now, Move the Sticks with Daniel Jeremiah and Bucky Brooks.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Move the Sticks, presented by Castrol Edge. DJ Bucky back with you. Buck, did you get a chance to watch the national championship game last night?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, man. It was a lot of fun to check out. I think, you know, obviously, when you look at what Alabama has done and you marvel at their success and the success of Nick Saban and what he's created down there. But then also, they're a bunch of really good players. And I think what is funny is that you can see two teams with really good players and one looks like they are so superior to the other when you put them on the field together. It was remarkable to watch. Hats off to Alabama. Terrific run. And what I would say is probably the most challenging season that we've seen in college football in a long time due to the pandemic.
Yeah, we're going to get to some of these NFL topics as well. What happened with Philadelphia with Doug Peterson moving on? Where does he make sense? What makes sense for the Eagles going forward? We'll touch on some other NFL topics, but I do think we should stay here on this college championship game here for a moment because so many different things to talk about. You mentioned the difference between the two teams. I tweeted it out. It looked like Alabama was playing 7-on-7 against the scout team. I mean, it literally looked like a Thursday practice. 7-on-7, sit back there and just pick them apart.
Yeah, and I just felt like for so long with Ohio State, we're so used to them having a special dude or multiple special dudes up front. They didn't have that, and you cannot beat Alabama if you don't have any dogs up front in the trenches. And because Mac Jones was able to really throw from a grassy knoll without any kind of pressure to rest, it was a game of 7-on-7. I will also say this. Steve Sarkisian got Texas fans really excited. Now, the problem is he won't get to bring those players with him, but the creativity that he displayed, a way that he attacked that Ohio State defense, I think what we have seen is Steve Sarkisian has grown, in my mind, a lot as a play caller from the time he was at SC and the time that he had the opportunity to run the offense in Atlanta. I think he has really gone up a notch in terms of his creativity and his aggressiveness. Of course, you can do that when you have all the weapons. I mean, like, it's easy to be the bully when you got the gun and all the bullets. Yeah. But so he did a really good job.
I want to revisit a topic that we had talked about earlier on the season. And we mentioned kind of this as an outlier because we talked about the need to be more athletic at the quarterback position. Because offensive line play in the NFL is not great in terms of what the college game has given you. So as a young quarterback who's not going to have all the answers to the tests, in other words, you're not going to be Drew Brees or Tom Brady and have all the knowledge to know where all your answers are, that the ability to kind of get away and escape versus a free rusher, not asking for a rush for 80 yards, but you got to be mobile enough to be able to be sudden enough to get away from those guys, was a necessity in the NFL. Now, we look at this game, and Mac Jones is not a statue. Mac Jones can move a little bit. Like, he's not somebody that's completely statuesque. But he's not the most athletic guy in the world, Buck. And you watch him on that stage, and you mentioned that he's got a great play caller. He's got a great offensive line and all these stud receivers. But he was pretty efficient, man. And I'm going to really look forward to digging in on his tape. I haven't done it yet. But it causes you to think, okay, you can make some exceptions here for guys that maybe aren't the most athletic if you can process and deliver the ball as accurately as he did last night.
Yeah, the way that he played, I think it certainly changes. You're going to have people put him in that conversation as a mid-first-round player. Where does he stack up? I've seen some guys say, hey, he's the fifth quarterback, or maybe some will put him ahead of Trey Lance for whatever reason. I think here's the thing, and I think it's tough, and I think as we continue to evolve when it comes to evaluating quarterbacks, is sometimes as much as we can, we have to take away the things that are around him and really look at the player itself. Because when Mac Jones goes to the National Football League, he won't necessarily have the fortress in front of him. He may not have all the pass catchers or whatever. And we could say the same thing. Tua didn't have that. And we saw Tua at Miami, and Tua looks different in Miami than the version that we saw at Alabama. Whereas Justin Herbert didn't have all those things, played with less, and you know, like he played a little better when he was surrounded by stuff. I think it's going to be important to be able to separate Mac Jones from scheme, play caller, and the playmakers around him. But I will say his ability to process, his ability to make the ball get out and throw with touch timing and anticipation is impressive. I just don't know now, DJ, in this time, when was the last time that we've seen a quarterback that is like that, drafted high, and play really, really well.
Yeah, that's what we talked about. That's what we talked about. The bus, if you look at the guys who haven't worked out, if you're talking about Rosen and Haskins, that was a little bit of the knock on those guys.
Yeah, and so
different
I want
people. different people, but
yeah, different people. But when we look just the way the game is trending, who's the young player that is like that? Like, I guess maybe we could throw Jared Goff in that conversation somewhat, but then we hear the conversation negatively on Jared Goff and how Sean McVay has to do so much and how they were excited about John Wolford because it enabled them to do more stuff. And so how many offensive coordinators are signing up for that style quarterback? Yeah. You know? And so it just makes it like there's a role for him, but I think his path is narrower than the path for some other guys when it comes to playing quarterback.
And again, I'm really looking forward to diving into the tape because, you know, Baker is not a great athlete. He's an okay athlete, but he can move around a little bit. Yes. He throws well on the move and those things. But that might be something. I'm thinking of Kirk Cousins. I'm thinking of Baker Mayfield, like those.
What's the common denominator? System. The system that they're playing in.
It matters.
Yeah, the system that they're playing in. Both of them are playing in similar systems. That Shanahan system, the stretch bootleg system, where they create a lot of easy opportunities for the quarterback. You just have to be mobile enough to get to the tackle box, to the edge of the tackle box in terms of the bootleg. If you can do that, you can play in that system. And with all the play action and all that other stuff, they make it easy. But without A-level athleticism, really B-level athleticism, it does make it more challenging for the play caller because you have to be very accurate with your play calls. He doesn't have the ability to erase some of your mistakes unless when we get in the meeting room, he can erase it with his mind because he's so good at processing and making checks and winning the pre-snap phase.
So a couple teams that I actually was just thinking about with him, and again, we'll do the full workup. We have time to do that. It's a long process before we get to the draft. We can flesh all this out. But just top of my head, looking at this draft order here, which we know now through picks 24. By the way, good weekend for the Jets as they end up with the 23rd pick now for that Jamal Adams trade. But when you look at two teams, Indianapolis and Pittsburgh, perfect. What do those teams have? They have good infrastructure. Pittsburgh is always going to have receivers. Juju's a free agent, but with Chase Claypool and all the other weapons that they have, it's a good foundation. Yes. And so I think that fits his skill set there. And then in Indy, he's going to be protected, good offensive line. And, you know, I know that they have another quarterback there from Jacob Eason. So they've got another young quarterback with totally different skill set. He's got a howitzer, huge arm. But I think Mac Jones, just in terms of the accuracy,
he plays the position better.
He plays it more similarly to Phillip, you know, to the way Phillips played it there. But those are teams. And that's why when we look at a guy like that who's used to playing with great players, he's had a talent advantage on his side, he might get the benefit of going in the bottom of the first round, going to a better team.
Yeah, and I think that certainly plays a role in the success of the quarterback. I mean, sometimes you go later, you get picked up by a better team, you have better not only better coaching, but you have a better support system around you. And so the pass catchers that you have, the running game, the offensive line, all of those things impact how you perform at the position. And so for Mac Jones, and I think we have to throw Kyle Trask also into that conversation in terms of the athletic limitations. Yeah, like you have to kind of put them in the same category in terms of stylistically how they play and the teams that will look for those quarterbacks and teams that can succeed with those quarterbacks. They're not as many, but there's still some guys who still prefer to have a guy that can do it. Tampa Bay is one of those teams that still can win with those kinds of guys because they're built like that and because Byron Leftwich, the play caller, and Bruce Arians are very comfortable with that style of quarterback.
Yeah. What were some of the other takeaways, Buck? I mean, we talked about the positive there with Mac Jones, the way he played, how he helped himself. Switch it over to Justin Fields. What did you see from him last night?
Oh, I mean, I think the game that he had in the semifinal game, I think that'll be the pinnacle. I think the people that really like him and endorse everything that he brings to the table, they will point to the Clemson game. I think the Alabama game showed what I kind of expected to see because the complexity a little bit of what Alabama does in terms of the pre-snap, post-snap stuff, I think it's going down.
Let me cut you off. I want to cut you off here because I want to do an exercise just because we've done this in the room, right? So we're getting ready to talk about Justin Fields. Let's focus what can he do, okay? Let's just go, you know, when you're in the draft room and we start having these discussions, say, no, I know what the limitations – I don't want to hear about the limitations. What can he do? So after we've seen Justin Fields in these two games, tell me what can Justin Fields do?
first thing that comes to mind is he's tough because he played with the injury, his toughness. He got hit. He hung in there. The game got away from them, and I didn't see him fold up to 10 and absolutely just let go of the rope. I think he has big-time arm talent. I think his arm talent to be able to push the ball down the field, even though he's late, he can make up for it with his ability to put pace and velocity on the ball. I think he's an outstanding athlete, and I think his athleticism was limited by the fact that he was dealing with an injury. But when he did scoot out, you could see how, as a runner, he can create conflict for the defense when he gets out in space. And I think the final thing is, I think what he can be is, I think you can see the developmental potential based on the fact that he was, 20-2? He has 22 collegiate starts, and I think you can imagine the possibilities. But I think it may take time, and I think system is going to be very, very important in terms of what you put him in.
Yeah, that's good, man. I tough, talented are the two big ones I put down. I would put, even just watching some of the pregame stuff, like you could see those guys rally around him. He's got a little bit of that galvanizing effect. So I would put leadership down there. We'll talk to coaches and get more info on that, but that seems to be a strength for him. The athleticism, to me, what you can do with that is endless. We saw him. Look, he was hurt. He was injured playing through that. He still was, what did he have, 67? Yeah, six carries for 67 yards. Against that group, and he's not. They said 95% in the pregame. There's no way.
95%.
So I've got that. I've got that athleticism to work with. I've got the competitiveness, the toughness. We talked about the ability to make every throw, and the thing that I talk about what he can do. He's going to get better. It's like, to me, where his ceiling is, he's nowhere near where he can get. Now there's times where you see him get locked on, and there's a couple throws in that game. Where we say, okay, you need to take a little bit off. But I think all that stuff's in front of him. So I'm actually just, even when I'm saying something kind of negative, to me it's a positive because he hadn't played a lot, and I feel like he's got more ahead of him. So some of these guys like Mac Jones, we just talked about him. He's good, but he is kind of where he is. Like,
that's where he is. There's no more.
Yeah, Justin Fields, there's a lot more meat left on that bone.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to, we've seen it, and I'm telling you now, like with the quarterback evaluation, I think you have to really be very imaginative in terms of looking at the prospect and the ceiling, because Josh Allen, where Josh Allen was as a college prospect to where Josh Allen is as a player, over a 3-year period, he got better. And so coaching, system, and supporting cast matters. And I think for Justin Fields, if he decides to come out, I think those things really, really matter. And it just depends, man, because you hear all these things. And I think it'd be interesting because what I wish, and I know we don't have the luxury of doing, I would love to have seen Zach Wilson play in those kinds of games. I would love to see him play in a semifinal game, a championship game, where he's playing against another team that's talented, that really pushes him to have to kind of put more on him. We don't get that, and that's fine, but I do wonder what that would have looked like.
Yeah, look, if you want to have that conversation, you can say Zach Wilson's kind of premier game and center stage moment was against Coastal Carolina. And I'm a Zach Wilson guy. Like, I love Zach Wilson, the way he plays. And coming through this process where we are up until these games, I've had him over Justin Fields. I haven't got a chance to watch the tape yet of these two semifinal games, so that's going to be a big part of the evaluation. But that's on the pod, I love it when we kind of take people behind the curtain, because this is a conversation, I guarantee you. Now, it might be in Zoom, I guess, because they're not going to have traditional draft meetings. But this is a heated conversation in draft rooms between, you've got the one scout who maybe did the West Coast and is standing on the table for Zach Wilson. You've got the Midwest scout who's standing on the table for Justin Fields. And the two arguments are, Zach Wilson's ahead of him right now. When you look at where he is in terms of his polish, his ability to make all these throws and play better. He just simply played better than Justin Fields. So that's what you're saying. And then the other guy from the Midwest is saying, yeah, that's great. You played on some teal turf against Coastal Carolina. This guy's playing against Nick Saban and Clemson in a semifinal game and a national championship game. One of those games, he tore him apart. The other game, he was out there hobbled and injured and was competitive. He didn't look out of place at all in that field. So that's the debate that's taking place.
Yeah, no, I think it will be an interesting debate. And I think really this comes down to styles and preferences and what do you want. I will say this. Zach Wilson is a quicker processor. I just think he's more of a natural pocket passer than Justin Fields. I think Justin Fields is a more talented athlete and player, playmaker. And so what do you want at the position? What, and I think it's important that the scouts scout the coaches, because you have to know what your offensive coordinator, his capacity to bring things out of quarterbacks and what he can do and the creative part of it, because I think that's what it comes down to.
You want to hear a random analogy here? I was just thinking about these two guys, right? So we're trying to get the image. To me, you've got one quarterback in Zach Wilson that would win in horse, right? Every type of throw you would try and make, if you're playing horse in the backyard basketball, for those that don't know, I got to make a shot. If I make a shot, you've got to make the same shot.
You got to make a shot. I got to match the shot. Yeah.
You got to match it. He can make every type of throw from any platform, in any direction, any trajectory, anything. So he's kind of like he would win in horse. And then when I think of Justin Fields, I think he has more horsepower.
Yes.
What it is. He just got more. There's just more in him in terms of being able to. They both have big arms, but I think Justin Fields can get a little bit more. And then with his as a runner, he just is more forceful, you know.
Yeah, and the stature is also going to come into play too. Oh,
because, that's a great point.
You know, like Justin Fields is 230 pounds, like, and he's built like he's thicker, he's dense,
broad shouldered. Zach Wilson looks narrow.
Yeah, Zach Wilson isn't like that. Yeah, and so you just think about the stuff and some of the quarterback run game. And that's why I think it was really important. And I'm glad like Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson were able to advance in the playoffs, because that was going to be the debate. If they didn't advance, then the argument kind of dies a little bit in the war room when you talk about, hey, let's look at how these guys have been able to succeed and flourish as guys that weren't necessarily hailed as polished prospects. Well, now that they advance and one of those guys is going to be in the championship game, I think the debate now, you can get a willing ear to listen to that. And so it'd be interesting, because why can't we have four quarterbacks that all end up being pretty good with Trey Lance? Because Trey Lance is the one that gets thrown out of the conversation because we didn't see him as much this year. And so that showcase game was whatever it was.
Which wasn't a good game for him.
Yeah, he kind of falls by the wayside, but he should also be included in that conversation when we talk about the top four.
Yeah, and you talk about having horsepower and the size and the physicality. And, oh, man, the toughness off the charts. So he's going to be – watch, he's going to be somebody that started out hot in the process. We didn't see him this year, but for a single game, falls back and then comes back forward. Yeah, he's that guy. Every year we have one, right? He's going to be that guy this year.
He is, and then in a year or two, we're like, man, I don't know how – why didn't anybody take him? I can't believe everybody passed on Trey Lance. Like, and we're going to be like
– But I do think – I mean, we've said for a long time, we think four in the top 10. And Mac Jones kind of entering the conversation, you know, as potentially a fifth first rounder. We'll see. You know, Kyle Trask, I got to do more work on him. Man, it's a quarterback year. But
quarterback year, I absolutely believe, like, and I know, like, it's mock drafting season, and I know – it's only so much gas that you have, right? So you can't empty your stuff, but there has to be four that go in the top 10. Mm-hmm. There has to, just counting the number of teams that need them that are in the top 10, the first two teams, two right out there, Atlanta has to get one. The Carolina Panthers have to get one.
I don't sleep on Detroit, and I wouldn't sleep on Philadelphia.
Right. So DJ, like, yes. So right there, that puts you in the mix. Four have to be in the conversation. Like, it has to be a done deal.
Yeah, which is going to push some of these receivers down, which, again, let's get to that, because I was talking before we came on with Nabil and Mark, and we were talking about Devontae Smith. How high can he go? You know, the knock on him is the frame and all that. I mean, he's a phenomenal route runner. The production, the hands, run after catch, he checks all the other boxes. He just doesn't have that frame. It doesn't have maybe that, you know, time speed is not going to blow you away, but we've all long said that's overrated. That being said, when you look at receivers that go in the top five, you're talking about freak shows. You're talking about Calvin Johnson, Larry Fitzgerald, Andre Johnson. These guys are freaks, like physical freaks. You don't see undersized guys. I mean, if you're looking at historically kind of the smaller guys, think about Peter Wark, and that didn't work out well.
The last two that were not what we call prototypical big body guys that win the top 10, Tavon Austin and John Ross.
Yeah.
And it didn't work out well for either guy. And I think if I am going to take a receiver in the top 10, I want to win the beauty pageant. And I think the bigger thing is this, DJ, because we'll have that conversation in war rooms. What is the difference between Devonta Smith and some of the guys that potentially will fall in the second round? A Rashad Bateman, a Rondale Moore, or whatever. And how big is that gap? Is it a sizable gap to make me say, no, I absolutely have to take this guy in the top 10 because I won't get another player in the draft that has comparable skills and ability to give me similar impact?
So I got asked about this. Somebody was asking about the Jets, right? Might even have been Rich. I don't know. But somebody's asking about the Jets. Do you take Devonta Smith if you're the Jets and then, you know, stick with Sam Darnold, you give him a weapon, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Let me just tell you, let me just give you, we talked about it all year long. I mean, look, Justin Jefferson and Ayuk, CeeDee Lamb, those guys all had great years. Let me give you the wide receivers in the second round, just in this last draft. You tell me who the bad player is, Buck. T. Higgins, Michael Pittman, LaVisca Chenault, K.J. Hamler, Chase Claypool, Van Jefferson, Denzel Mims. Who's the bad player in that group?
There's not one.
So how do you take one up there? How do you do that?
There's not one. And so my biggest thing has been maybe we shouldn't draft a wide receiver in the first round because we're seeing so many guys come out of the second and third round have success.
There's a million of them.
Right. Maybe you just go, and, hey, look, I love him. I love him as a player. We can give him his due, give him the grade that he wants, but we don't need to take him. We don't need to take him there when we can take an offensive tackle. As we talk about the marquee positions, if we think about this simply, what are the premium positions on the team? And we talk about in the trenches and at quarterback. I mean.
Well, that's why, like, answer me this. Answer me this one. I've said I think I would rather have Kyle Pitts in the first round because I don't find anybody like Kyle Pitts. I'm not going to find anybody like him in the second round of this draft. I can find receivers. I mean, Jamar Chase, I love him. I think he's the best one in the draft. But I can find other dudes in the second round that come in and help.
Get him all the time. I can get A.J. Brown. I can get a Michael Thomas.
People will say, well, look, you know, look, Kelsey wasn't a first rounder, and you look at Kittle wasn't a first rounder. Yeah, but I can find you loads of picks that were second, third round tight ends that did nothing. I just gave you the list of every single receiver picked in the second round last year. They're all hit. Every single
all
one of them.
All of them. You know, and the thing about Kyle Pitts, the only question has little to do with him and more to do with the play caller. Yeah. Because does your coordinator have a clear understanding for how to utilize a talent like that? And I think the problem is when we see tight ends taken in the top 10 the last few years, Eric Ebron, TJ Hockenson, I don't know if the guys who were drawing up the plays knew how to feature the tight end so you can get the value, you can get the return on the investment.
They've been good players. I mean, they've been good players, even though it took Ebron going to another location.
So that would be the thing. Yeah, but Kyle Pitts is different. I think you have to look for in the first round, I want a unicorn. Yep. I want something that I can't get elsewhere. I want something that is different. And if we do it like that, then it really limits what positions we would even target. Years ago, I had this debate because I was slow to come around on Quentin Nelson because, look, old school thoughts, old school thinking was you don't draft a guard. You don't draft a guard that high.
Yeah.
But he's a unicorn, though. Like, he's a unicorn. He's something different. When you looked at the way that he played guard compared to anybody else that played guard, he's different. So in the first round, I want unicorns. I want things that I'm not going to necessarily see in this lifetime.
You know, the other interesting thing is you want tackles. You want offensive tackles. Take them in the first round, man. Like I look at teams and say, well, you know what? I need a tackle. I need a receiver. You better take your tackle first, man.
Because they're not coming around.
They ain't going to be there. They're all gone. So you can hold off and wait on. I need a running back, a receiver. Wait, you're fine. You get some. They're everywhere.
Supply and demand. The difference in your first tier, top tier tackles and your second tier tackles, it's a bigger gap between those and your first tier wideouts and your second tier wideouts and some of those other positions.
I think those wideout tiers just kind of blend in together, you know?
So, and a lot of it is due to like what offense are they in, what scheme, how they utilize, how do they feature? I think that's the other thing too. And this isn't a knock because Devonta Smith and Mac Jones and all those guys are good, but sometimes when you're scouting, you have to be able to separate scheme from the talent of the player. And I would say Sark was in his bag. He was doing everything to create to get Devontae Smith 12 catches in the first half. I was sitting there like, my gosh, like how do you move someone around and do those things or whatever? But you have to be able to separate that, because if we take him out, because if we put Devontae Smith in a static offense that doesn't move much, like if we put him in Philadelphia, are they going to be able to utilize him?
We got to find out who their coach is first.
You know, like can they utilize him to really tap into the talent and the potential that he has?
Yeah, no. Another big winner from the game last night was Barmore, who, it was funny, they were talking about him on the broadcast, the defensive tackle, Christian Barmore for Alabama. When you watch him during the year, when you really study him, he's got some bad games, man. Like, there's games where he doesn't do anything. Like, I want to say the South Carolina game, very disappointing. And then he flashes in other games. And then, of course, he comes on the national scene here in these two games and plays lights out. And
everybody's on him.
Everybody's on him, but I would just offer this little bit of caution, because if you remember when Clemson played Bama, I think this is the one they lost to Bama in with Watson, one of the first ones there. No, it might have been the one they won. But Kevin Dodd, you remember him? Kevin Dodd and Shaq Lawson were the two edge rushers for Clemson, and Shaq went crazy. Shaq had been kind of the guy. But man, Kevin Dodd came on at the end. He played gangbusters. I was at the game, so I took a big bite out of that apple. I think he's out of the league, Buck.
Yeah, he is. I mean, look, in a way, you could kind of say that about Cleveland Farrell. Like, yeah. Farrell had a big game on the big stage, kind of showed out and was very impressive. But we haven't seen that same kind of stuff at the next level. Injuries have played a part in it. But yeah, like, I think it is something like we want to give people credit for shining and showcasing in those big games. But you also want to reference the regular season, because the regular season does matter. Like, it does play a part in the evaluation. Like, you have to give it its proper due and make sure it slots into the puzzle pie.
Once you get outside the first couple rounds, I'm okay with some of those. But to me, like, my first two picks in a draft, I don't want misses, man. I go back to Ozzie Newsome, doubles, doubles, doubles. So give me the guy that's been the same guy from the beginning of the season to the end of the season. Maybe I sacrifice a little bit of what somebody could be, or I'm hoping and wishing. I don't want to hope and wish with my first two picks, man.
DJ, you have to nail it, because really, and I know we're draft guys and we love the draft and we like to romanticize about, hey, the fifth, you know, we find this guy in the fifth and sixth. The league is really a first and second round league. When you look at the rosters, like, it's really comprised of a bunch of first rounders and second rounders and then some others. And so if you can consistently nail the first round and find starters in the second and third rounds, your team is going to be fine. All the other stuff that happens in the fourth, fifth, sixth round, I'll say it, and it's not going to be probably, it's a lot of luck involved in that. Like, if your guy's a seventh round pick and he comes and becomes a starter and a high end starter, there's a lot of luck in that.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. All right, we mentioned it briefly there, talking about, you know, would somebody fit with the Philadelphia Eagles. They make the move. Doug Peterson is out. Now they're the seventh team now looking for a head coach. And I think Jet fans were not happy with me, because I had tweeted out, look, that would make some sense with the Jets. I'm not lobbying for him to go to the Jets. I'm not saying he's the favorite to go to the Jets. I'm just simply saying two things. I believe Doug Peterson is a good football coach, and I know Doug Peterson and Joe Douglas have a great relationship from their time together. That's it. That's all I'm saying. He'd be one of the candidates that they have to consider up there with the Jets.
Yeah, I mean, you're trying to connect the dots, because that relationship between head coach and general manager is critical. You have to see the game through the same prism. You have to be able to have the checks and balances built in, where you can have these hard conversations to make decisions on what we need to do, not only personnel wise, but what are we going to do from a coaching standpoint, staffing and all of those things. And so I understand it. It makes complete sense that you at least have to investigate and see if it's a right fit. You also, in my estimation, I want to bring Doug in at least for a long conversation, because I want to get his opinion on my quarterback. Yeah. I want to get another guy's opinion based on the quarterbacks that he's been around. Hey, you've seen Carson. You've seen Jalen Hurts. You've been around Foles and some other guys that have come through this building. Give me your take on our guy. Where do you think our guy is?
Shoot, he played with Brett Favre. He played with, you know, all those dudes.
Yeah, like, give me the pros. Give me the cons. What could he be? What would be, in your mind, the best plan to get him that? And even if I don't hire you, I want that intel. Because I'm trying to take all this data and figure out how can I make the best decision for my franchise going forward.
I'm laughing, by the way, as we're doing this, because the Raiders tweeted out that they hired Gus Bradley. That's not funny. I love Gus. We've known Gus forever. The funny thing is they put a picture of Ken Whisenhunt on the graphic when they announced they hired him. I'm like, yeah, that's not Gus. That's Ken Whisenhunt. So they took it down. I guess they have to put up a new one. But again, this is kind of this is what we talked about earlier, right? If you're a team that already has your head coach but is making a coordinator change, you better jump on it right away. So what have we seen? We've seen Dan Quinn, the Dallas Cowboys, probably had to overpay, I guarantee you, to be able to lock so that he does not have a chance to look elsewhere. Lock in Dan Quinn. Now it looks like the Raiders, who already have their head coach, who had a coordinator opening. Lock in Gus Bradley. If you think about, you know, Robert Saleh, his connections to Gus, anybody that's out here trying to get a job and looking for a veteran coordinator, you think Gus would be highly sought after. So lock him in. So I feel like the team's kind of taking the approach we thought they would.
Yeah, and I also think it is this. I don't think it's a coincidence with Gus Bradley and Dan Quinn that they have had success in their respective backgrounds as head coaches with young guys getting on the field. There are a lot of people that will knock the simplicity of this scheme, but the simplicity of the scheme enables you to develop and get young guys onto the field. And when you think about the way the league is trending, particularly if we're about to experience a salary cap crunch, young guys more than ever have to be able to get on the field and they have to be able to play. And so I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it's something to that. I think it's something to the developmental part of what both guys bring as leaders of their respective units.
I do like it when you have a coordinator stay inside the division. You get the Charger Raider thing there. That's kind of fun. Makes sense too from a family standpoint too. If you think about some of these coaches, you don't want to be bouncing around all over the place. You could probably, if you're Gus, you could probably still keep home base, you know, in Orange County.
You can fly back and forth. I mean, if you want to, like at night, he could do it. Like you fly at night, see the fam, come back early in the morning and get there. So yeah, it gives you more opportunities, more possibilities when it comes to that. But yeah, and also the familiarity in terms of knowing your division opponents. Yeah, I think that's a really big deal.
And if look, they haven't, they won the one at the end of the year when the Chiefs were taking a knee, but they have been competitive and they have done very well of slowing down Patrick Mahomes in that group.
If I'm not mistaken, did Gus work in Tampa with Gruden? I know Gus is a Marinelli man. I don't know, but I know there's something. I know Gus and Rod Marinelli were together. And with Rod being there, I could see all of that kind of working together. I feel like it's really important that John Gruden wanted that scheme, that stuff. He may just not have wanted like Rod to take all of that stuff on, the challenges of calling it and doing it maybe at his age and stuff like that.
I believe it's the same thing in terms of you better get your front four, get after it. Gus not big on, you know, sending a bunch of exotic pressure. See, you need to get home with four, you know, play that single high a lot and keep the ball in front of you, rally and tackle.
Yeah, no, it's funny in having conversation with Gus, and you'll know more because you studied Chargers every week. But Gus had talked to me about, like, Pete was so big on the three deep zone or whatever, but Gus working with Rod Marinelli, he liked the Tampa 2 stuff, and that their original playing in Seattle was to basically morph what Rod Marinelli and Monty Kiffin and those guys did in Tampa with the Tampa 2, but to do it with the three deep zone. And he felt like the best of both worlds was to be able to do both things, play Tampa 2 and that cover 3 and put it together so quarterbacks knew that they couldn't always just throw it to the flat without some resistance from the corner showing up and doing some of that stuff.
No doubt. All right. Well, anybody you like here for the Eagles gig here?
You know, it's really tough because, you know, the reports that come out of there, it's about Lurie wanting to know what is the future vision, because this team is kind of at a crossroads in terms of the cap situation, making some decisions. You have the quarterback stuff or whatever. Obviously, whoever comes in has to have a plan for getting Carson Wentz back right. They also have to have a plan for building a team that can win the division. And DJ, you've talked to me about this team just doesn't invest in linebackers. They never really seen it as a thing. And I think at some point, though, like if they want their defense to be up to the level of the competitors in the division, they're going to have to put something in the linebacker position. Great up front, something in the back end, but you got to get some players.
So one of the things I was thinking about it, and where they're picking six. So, you know, look, they could decide that neither one of their current quarterbacks are their guy, and they could take one at six. They could try and take a receiver to come in. Man, it's just tough when you – I love Ja'Marr Chase, but, man, going receiver back-to-back in the first rounds is difficult when you can find them anywhere else.
I don't think you can do that. I think you have to put the onus on Jalen Reagor. You got to get better. Like, you have to be better. You have to be the impact player. We take you in the first round for a reason. We expect you to be this player in 2021. You have to play to that level.
But I think about the salary cap mess that they're in. To me, it actually makes a lot of sense. If we're talking about four quarterbacks going, if they could multiple times trade back and get as many picks, not only this year, but even next year, and try and have a two-year period where, look, we're going to have to play. We're going to have to roster a lot of rookies, and they're going to have to roster some undrafted free agents, because we're going to have to clean up all the salary cap mess that they find themselves in.
Yeah, and I think that's going to have to be a very transparent conversation. But what that does, though, it creates a lot of pressure, because if you're talking about a roster rebuild or retool, your quarterback has to be able to play in the midst of that. And with all the pressure that is going to be on him, because people are going to view this as a power struggle, like, he is going to have to be able to get back on track, and he's going to be able to – he needs to be able to do more with less. And I don't know if that's what – Jeffrey Lurie is going to sign up for when it comes to, look, I'm writing this big check. Am I confident that my quarterback can do it? I think he may have to devote some more resources to make sure that Carson gets off the ground.
So here's a challenge for teams that are going to have to clean up the salary cap. Is, I think you need to find a way to get two things. You need to find a way to get youth, right? But, man, if you can get maturity to go along with that youth, they can coexist. You can actually find a young kid, rookies, that are passionate and professional and mature, so you can infuse this life and all this young blood into your organization, but you get the right kids that come out of the right places and are wired the right way. Now you've got a chance to have some success. You don't have to go through a lean years of being 4-12 if you get some mature young guys to put in the mix.
Does that mean I need to go back and I need to put on the thing and say, we want four-year players, guys that have graduated, guys who come from winning programs? Do we need to go back and have that conversation all over again and make sure that we're getting the right guys in the program?
I don't think that's dated, man. I really don't.
You know, I think that works. And I don't know if some of the listeners haven't heard. The reason why it was desirable, when I was in Carolina, John Fox was a big fan of college graduates, guys who had at least been in college 4 years, guys who had earned their degree. And part of it was because of the maturity that is necessary. Part of that is also the goal setting and the goal completion. You started in school, you finished school, you spent 4 years there, so you've gone through the full developmental process. If you're on a winning team, because you also wanted guys that came from winning programs, you understand the sacrifice and the work that goes into being a winner, because he didn't want to have to spend a whole lot of time teaching guys how to be professionals. Yeah. You would like them to understand that coming in. So now we can focus on tactics and schemes and your own development and stuff like that. And so it does help if you have a mature player that comes in and understands that you don't have to babysit them.
I agree with you. This has been fun. We could do this all day, man. It's been great to catch up, Buck. Anything else you want to add before we get out of here?
No, that's it, man. Just looking forward to the games this weekend, the divisional round, being able to kind of separate these teams. It's fascinating. It's fascinating when you see the matchups that we have.
Well, I'm pumped for this time of year. I feel like I got three jobs, right? I do the Charger thing, we do the Amazon thing, and we do our work here at NFL Media Group. So two are done, man. Put two to bed, and now a draft is coming, and we can dive in. So it's a fun time of year. Want to thank everybody for helping us here as we got this bad boy up and running. Want to thank Nabil, Mark, as always. Cole joining the team, doing a great job as well. So appreciate you guys, and we'll see you next time right here on Move the Sticks, presented by Castrol Edge.